Morning, everyone. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, we haven't had the reading yet. What's that idiot doing getting up there before we've had the reading? Well, I know we're Anglicans, but sometimes we can change. And today we're going to do it a bit differently. I want to give a brief intro, and then Mabu's going to come and read chapter 3 of Jonah to us. And then I'm going to speak for a bit, and then she's going to come back again and read chapter 4. So, as Martin said, we're in the third and final part of our series on the book of Jonah. If you haven't been around thus far, then here's basically what's happened. So Jonah is a tiny little book of the Bible tucked away towards the end of the Old Testament. It is, I believe, not an historical account, but rather a fable or a parable which teaches us truths about God and about ourselves. It is written beautifully, every word in place. It's funny, it's fun, it's engaging and challenging. The word of the Lord came to Jonah and said, go to Nineveh. But Jonah knew that Nineveh was a bit of a dodgy place, and so he legged it off in exactly the opposite direction, got on a boat and went out into the middle of the sea. God sent a storm as a not-so-subtle reminder to Jonah of what he was meant to be doing. Eventually, Jonah gets the sailors to throw him overboard. He's drowning. God sends a big fish to swallow Jonah up. And Jonah spends what we discussed last week is an idiomatic 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish. What I mean by that is it's not literal, but rather 3 days and three nights was an idiom that people used to describe a long journey. So Jonah has this long journey down to the very depths characterized by despair, distress. He felt that he was deep in the realm of the dead. He was as far from God as it was possible to be. He shouted at God. He cried out to God. He prayed and he praised. And at the end of chapter 2, the big fish vomits him up onto the beach. And that's where we join the story today. So Mabu, would you come and read to us?
Then the word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time. Go to the great city of Nineveh and proclaim to it the message I give you. Jonah obeyed the word of the Lord and went to Nineveh. Now Nineveh was a very large city. It took 3 days to go through it. Jonah began by going a day's journey into the city, proclaiming, 40 more days and Nineveh will be overthrown. The Ninevites believed God. A fast was proclaimed, and all of them, from the greatest to the least, put on sackcloth. When Jonah's warning reached the king of Nineveh, he rose from his throne, took off his royal robes, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat down in the dust. This is the proclamation he issued to Nineveh. By the decree of the king and his nobles, do not let people or animals, herds or flocks, taste anything. Do not let them eat or drink, but let people and animals be covered with sackcloth. Let everyone call urgently on God. Let them give up their evil ways and their violence. Who knows? God may yet relent and with compassion turn from his fierce anger so that we will not perish. When God saw what they did and how they turned from their evil ways, he relented and did not bring on them the destruction he had threatened. This is the word of the God.
Thanks, Mabu. So in chapter 1 and verse 1, we read, the word of the Lord came to Jonah. In chapter 3 and verse 1, we read, the word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time. And I love that. We believe in a God of the second chance, and the third chance, and the fourth, and the fifth, and the sixth. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, and Jonah did exactly the opposite. But God gave him a second chance. Some of you might know that England are currently playing a test match against India. And I don't know what's happening right now, and it's making me a little bit nervous. But we're getting towards the end of it. And India is a notoriously difficult place for England, or for any country, actually, to go and play cricket. And 4 days ago, on the first morning, later on, Tom Hartley, a young debutant spin bowler for England, was asked to open the bowling by Captain Ben Stokes. It was a pretty nasty thing to get into. He'd literally never done it before in the whole of his life, let alone in test match cricket. His very first ball got slogged for six by the Indian batsman. Bad start. His first over went for 12. Awful start. Ben Stokes, the captain, could have taken him off at that point, gave him a second chance. He bowled the second over. It went for 13. Awful. Most captains would have taken him off. Ben Stokes gave him another chance. His first four overs, he was going at 10 and over. Awful. Ben Stokes gave him another chance. His first 10 overs went for 70. Horrific. Ben Stokes stuck with him. Stuck with him. Later on in that innings, he took his first couple of international wickets. This morning, in India's second innings, who did Ben Stokes turn to for the very first ball of the innings? Tom Hartley. And he is currently, I hope, bowling England to victory. Not counting too many chickens yet, but he's taken four wickets. He's knocked out some of the best batsmen in the world because the captain Ben Stokes gave him a second, a third, and a fourth chance. Well, I wasn't sure I would ever say this in a sermon, but God is like Ben Stokes. He's not quite as good in the field, though. God is like Ben Stokes because he's the God of the second chance. You see, we might give up on God, but God never gives up on us. We might run out on God, but God never runs out on us. We might abandon our calling, but God never abandons our calling. I wonder if perhaps today you feel like you've given up on God or run out on God or run away from the things he was asking you to do. Well, hear the good news from chapter 3 of Jonah. There is always a way back to God. He's the God of the second chance. However worthless you feel, however wrong you feel you've acted, however badly you feel you've acted, there is always a way back to God. So, Jonah goes to Nineveh. And as we've said in our previous two chapters, Nineveh was the original sin city, renowned for corruption, abuse, trafficking, prostitution, murders. It was an awful place filled with people doing awful things. So fair play to Jonah for going. But the truth is that once he gets there, he does a pretty rubbish job. We're told the city of Nineveh takes 3 days to walk across. Actually, again, this is a bit of an idiom. There weren't any cities of that time big enough to take 3 days to walk across. It simply means it would take a long journey to get across. It was a big city. So 3 days to get across, but Jonah goes 1 day into the city. So he doesn't even do a full job, just 1 day in. And then he preaches the following sermon. 40 more days and Nineveh will be overthrown. That's it. Now I know that some of you are sitting there just wishing that I could be as succinct. But seriously, that's a rubbish sermon. He doesn't mention God. He doesn't mention why the city's going to be overthrown. He doesn't mention how the city's going to be overthrown. It is a rubbish five-word sermon. Now, the smart Alex amongst you might be sitting there thinking, hang on, 40 more days and Nineveh will be overthrown. That's 8 words, you idiot. Well, I'm talking about the original Hebrew, so who's the smart Alex now? In the original Hebrew, just 5 words. What a paltry offering. By paltry offering, I mean like a rubbish offering rather than a paltry offering. This is not chicken sacrifice I'm talking about here. paltry, pathetic, meager, threadbare kind of offering. He's doing the bare minimum. And yet God does something extraordinary with it. You see, God is not only the God of the second chance, he's a God who can take even our meager offerings and transform them to achieve something extraordinary. It might be that today you're feeling, a bit like in that song that we just sung in Oceans, that your head is only just above the waves. You're just getting by. It might be that you feel a bit like the things we were talking about in Jonah chapter 2 last week, that actually you're down in the depths, you're in distress, you feel like you're deep in the realm of the dead. Maybe you feel as far from God as it is possible to be. Or maybe at the moment you're just tired, exhausted, burned out, unwell. Or perhaps you feel that you don't really have anything to offer. You don't have many skills or gifts or talents. You're not clever or influential or powerful or dynamic. Well, the great news is we don't have to be. We don't have to be the best at things. We don't have to have lots to offer. But we are asked to offer what we have. And just as in the New Testament, when Jesus sees the widow giving her tiny offering of money into the pot in relation to all these rich chaps giving loads, but he says what she gave is worth more than everything that they gave. Out of her poverty, she gave freely. And the same goes for us with our money, but with our time, with our skills, with all that we have to offer. So even if you feel like you've got nothing to offer right now, either because you're not clever or skillful enough, or because you're far from God, or because you're tired or exhausted, or because you're only just getting by, offer what you have. Offer who you are. And you never know what God might do with it. So God does something extraordinary in the city of Nineveh. But before we get to that, a little aside, because I think it's fascinating and it reminds us of how beautifully this book is written. So Jonah's sermon, pathetic. But the way that the writer of Jonah has written Jonah's sermon, glorious. That last word, overthrown, has a delightful double meaning. It's actually literally overturned. And the main kind of primary meaning for this word is overturned, meaning destroyed. But its secondary subsidiary meaning is turned over, as in turned over a new leaf. And so the writer here is kind of tantalizingly offering us this chance to see that there's a choice that the people of Nineveh has. I'm not sure Jonah realizes it when he preaches it, and the people of Nineveh don't realize it. But essentially, Jonah's sermon is 40 more days, and the city of Nineveh will either be overturned, destroyed, or the people will turn over a new leaf and be redeemed. Very clever. And it is the second that happens. Everyone in the city, from the poorest beggar up to the king, repent of their sins and turn to God. And to kind of show how committed they are to this, they do some of the things that people at that time did. They fasted and they wore sackcloth and ashes. In fact, and again, I think this is a little kind of humorous aside from the writer, even the animals wear sackcloth and ashes. Even the animals are sorry for their part in what's been going on. Just imagine some of the cows in a bit of burlap, the donkey in a spot of Hessian. They all turn to God. And at this point, they don't know what's going to happen. They're not turning to God in order to make him change. They're turning to God because they know it's the right thing to do. So, the king of Nineveh repents, fasts, wears sackcloth and ashes, and then he says, who knows, maybe God will relent. Now, to understand the power of those words, we need to know how the original readers or listeners to Jonah would have heard those words. Because you see, they are a direct echo of something that King David had said 500 years before Jonah was written. Now, this bit needs a warning. It's actually a tragic, heartbreaking story. So as you know, probably, King David had lots of ups and downs. We did a series on King David not long ago. One of his biggest downs was when he had an affair with Bathsheba. And in fact, if we're really honest, having an affair is probably generous. We don't know how much choice really she had in the matter. Bathsheba became pregnant, and in order to try and keep it all a secret, David arranged for Bathsheba's husband to be killed. Horrific, awful behavior. So no one knows what's happened, and the child is really ill. The prophet Nathan comes to King David and says to him, "You might think that no one knows, but God's seen what you've done. You need to repent of your evil." And David does. He repents of his sins. He fasts. He puts on sackcloth and ashes. And when people ask him why he's doing it, he says, "Who knows? Maybe God will relent." So here we have the king of Israel, King David, and the king of Nineveh, a pagan nation. They both repent of the sins that they've committed. They both fast. They both wear sackcloth and ashes. And they both say, "Who knows? Maybe God will relent." The city of Nineveh is saved. The king of Nineveh's prayers are answered. Tragically, Bathsheba's child dies. David's prayers are not answered. The truth is, we don't know why sometimes God answers our prayers in the way that we want him to, and why sometimes he doesn't. Anyone who can give you clear and precise reasons for that is either deluding themselves or you. We don't know the whys and the wherefores of it, and it's hard. It's heartbreaking. It's heart-rending. At times it feels wrong. I don't think we should skip over that or skirt around it. Life can be brutal. It can be hard. And there are times where we don't know what God is up to. We don't know why God answered the prayers of the king of Nineveh, but didn't answer the prayers of King David. What we do know is that what both men did was the right thing. They both turned to God. They both repented in their part of what was going on. And they sought the God of love. But the question, I suppose, for us is, what if we're going to acknowledge that God doesn't always answer our prayers in the way that we want? Well, why should we bother? Why should we turn to God? In order to help us think about that, we're going to hear from chapter 4 now. Because God does relent to the city of Nineveh, and so we would think everyone's going to be happy with the outcome. But Jonah, is not so happy. So let's read this chapter and then we'll come back to that really important question. Mabu, thank you. Chapter 4.
But to Jonah, this seemed very wrong, and he became angry. He prayed to the Lord, "Isn't this what I said, Lord, when I was still at home? That this is what I tried to forestall by the fleeing to Tarshish? I knew that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Now, Lord, take away my life, for it is better for me to die than to live." But the Lord replied, "Is it right for you to be angry? Jonah had gone out and sat at a place east of the city. There he made himself a shelter, sat in its shade, and waited to see what would happen to the city. Then the Lord God provided a leafy plant and made it grow up over Jonah to give shade for his head to ease his discomfort. And Jonah was very happy about it, about the plant. But at dawn the next day, God provided a worm which chewed the plant so that it withered. When the sun rose, God provided a scorching east wind, and the sun blazed on Jonah's head so that he grew faint. He wanted to die and said, "It would be better for me to die than to live." But God said to Jonah, "Is it right for you to be angry about the plant?" "It is," he said, "and I am so angry. I wish I were dead." But the Lord said, "You have been concerned about this plant, though you did not tend to it or make it grow. It sprung up overnight and died overnight. And should I not have concern for the great city of Nineveh, in which there are more than 120,000 people who cannot tell their right hand from their left, and also many animals?"
Thanks, Mabu. Beautifully read. So, the city of Nineveh has been saved. The prayers have been answered. Everyone's happy except for Jonah, who in full old Kevin mode says, "Oh God, I knew this was going to happen. So unfair. I can't believe you would do this. I just wish I was dead." Going to come back to what happens, and we will come back to that question I posed a few minutes ago as well. But before all of that, in order to get a full sense of this passage, we need to do a little bit of structural analysis, which I promise will be slightly less boring than it sounds. Let me ask you a question. I've got four sentences I'm going to read to you, and I want you to tell me what the four sentences have in common. Okay? So don't shout out until after I've read all four. So these are just four sentences. First one, was it a cat I saw? Second, a nut for a jar of tuna. Third, never odd or even. And fourth, a biblical one because, well, we are in church. Madam in Eden, I'm Adam. Anyone tell me? Palindromes, well done. Extra samosa for you after the service. Exactly, they're all palindromes, so they all read the same backwards and forwards. Was it a cat I saw? Never odd or even. A nut for a jar of tuna. And Madam in Eden, I'm Adam. And I realise there's probably three or four of you who I've lost for the rest of the sermon now, because you're going to sit there working that out, but that's okay. Well, Jonah chapter 4 is a sort of numerical palindrome. It doesn't quite work, but it's a literary rhetorical device that is very similar. So we begin with Jonah speaking 39 words. Then God says three words, Jonah says three. God says five, Jonah says five, and then God finishes with 39 words again. So not quite a palindrome, but it's similar. And it takes us on this sort of journey from the high of the beginning of Jonah saying some really good things about God, although in a slightly sneering voice, coming down to talk about Jonah's anger, and then coming back up again as God declares who he is and what he stands for. It's absolutely brilliant. Just like the rest of Jonah, every word is in its correct place. So these first 39 words then of Jonah, who is so angry at God. He says, "I knew you were going to do this. You are a God who is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in love." I mean, it's hard to understand how you can say that sounding really cheesed off, isn't it? But Jonah manages it. He's actually quoting here from another bit in the Bible, Exodus 34, where God declares it about himself as he gives, for a second time, the Ten Commandments to Moses. God says about himself, I am the Lord your God, the God who is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in love. And this is repeated dozens of times throughout the scriptures. So Jonah knows this inside out, and yet he still seems a bit surprised that God would be gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in love. And so he gets angry. Here we come down to the middle of this passage. He storms off out the city, sits on the hillside overlooking it, furious at God. It's hot, so God sends a vine to grow up over him to give him some shade. But then, to teach him a bit of a lesson, the next day he sends a worm, and the vine withers, and Jonah is left in the scorching sun. Apparently, Simon, our brilliant bassist, who this week was at a conference for medicine in the armed forces, they actually, whilst talking about soldiers suffering from heat stroke or heat exhaustion, reference this passage from Jonah, which is quite cool. So Jonah there, suffering from heat exhaustion, understandably a bit cross. God says, should you be angry? And he says, yes, of course I should. I loved that vine. And God said, you think you love that vine, but you didn't create it or tend it or nurture it. How much more do you think I love the people? And we get a little kind of wink and a nudge from the writer here, and the animals, because they repented too. How much more do you think I love the people and the animals of Nineveh? And this is the crux of the whole of the story of Jonah. It's the crux of the whole of the narrative arc of the Bible. It's the crux of the whole of history. God is love. And that's why, for me, even when I don't understand what God's up to, even when life seems brutal and harsh and wrong, even when events seem unfair, I choose to put my trust in God because I believe he's the God who is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in love. And that's not always easy, but it's a choice I make. This book shows us that God is with us and is good all the way through. So Jonah runs away from God, but God is love. Jonah gets himself thrown overboard, and God is love. Jonah goes down to the very depths, as far away from God as he can possibly be, and God is love. Jonah gives a fairly meager offering for what God is asking him to do, and God is love. Jonah doesn't understand why God acts in the way that he does, and God is love. Just like Jonah, I spend a lot of my life not knowing and not understanding, but it doesn't affect the fact that God is love and that he knows what he's doing. And my hope and prayer for us as we finish this series on Jonah is that that might resonate with us. There's all sorts of other bits and pieces which you might have picked up on, that you might have taken home with you, to do with calling, to do with running away, to do with being down in the depths, to do with praying and praising, to do with getting a second chance, to do with offering what we have to God. But my hope more than anything is that we would know that God is love, that he is good, and that he knows what he's doing. That, I believe, is what the writer of Jonah was trying to pass on to us. I hope you've enjoyed this series. We could have gone on for much longer. Maybe in 10 years' time when we do it again, we'll do lots more sermons because there's so much to pick out. But I think it's a glorious book. It's challenging, provocative, but greatly encouraging and really good fun. I've got to tell you, I've had a whale of a time.